Welcome back to Libromania, a podcast for the book obsessed, featuring interviews with contemporary authors, discussions about key figures and movements in literary history, examinations of various genres and current events in the literary world, and celebrations of book nerddom. You know, bookstores, book design, book collections, and more. I'm David Kern. This is chapter 16, in which I chat with one of the world's most foremost book cover designers, Mr. Paul Sayer, a man whose work you have seen numerous times, perhaps without even knowing it was his.
You know, with a book cover, it's a visual graphic representation of a story, a novel, the act of reading, right? And I would say the same thing about a theater poster. Most people see the poster before they see the show. The poster has information on it that you need, time, date, obvious stuff. But also, what is this show about? What am I getting into when I go to this thing? I view both as a doorway to some experience that someone has. You know, with a book cover, you see the cover before you open the book. And frankly, I don't care about the marketing part of it. I care about making something that's a doorway to an experience somebody's going to have and creating something that is appropriate and compelling and feels right for that situation.
Paul Sayer is a graphic designer who has operated his own independent practice since 1997. He's a frequent visual contributor to the New York Times. He's authored books, redesigned two of Canada's largest magazines, built and destroyed a life-size monster truck hearse for the band They Might Be Giants, and appeared in the 1990s when on a Rider film. He received his BFA and MFA from Kent State University and has taught graphic design at the School of Visual Arts for the past 13 years. He lectures extensively all over the world and is a member of Alliance Graphica Internationale. You've seen his work before. He's designed renowned covers for books by Chuck Klosterman and Malcolm Gladwell and others, and he's been charged with updating the covers for the likes of Ernest Hemingway and Muriel Spark. He's done design work for the Criterion Collection, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and many other media companies and publishers. Plus, he's the author of a memoir called Two Dimensional Man, in which he shares stories from his 30-year career. You can find it at Amazon or wherever you buy books. Elliot Earls calls it a, quote, gut-wrenching and at times hilariously compelling look into a designer's life. This is the only design monograph and memory I could honestly characterize as a page-turner, end quote. In today's episode, in this conversation, Mr. Sayer and I chatted about the process of designing a book cover and some of his favorite covers. If you subscribe to the notion that the old cliche, never judge a book by its cover, is nonsense, then this conversation is for you. Hope you enjoy. Thank you. Thank you for being here. This is a show for people who are, as we like to say, book obsessed, and the all the things that go into books besides just the reading of them, besides just the words, are something that we're all kind of intrigued by. So I love talking to people who do typography and layout and cover design. So this is great fun for me, and I appreciate that you took the time.
Oh yeah, thanks for asking. I wasn't familiar with your podcast, but I did. I mean, your subject matter is fantastic. I mean, some of the I got into a couple of them.
Well,
so yeah, I appreciate the diversity. You know, I'm typically talking to designers most of the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is it's nice to talk to the other side, I suppose.
Well, you know, one of the things I like to hear from I ask novelists this a lot about how they kind of, you know, what their motivations are for writing. Like, why do they put themselves through it? And, you know, a lot of novelists talk about how it's both great fun and really challenging to be a writer. You know, it's kind of a lonely thing. And I was wondering if that's true for designers too. Like when I mean, I'm sure there's some collaboration going on. You got to collaborate with, you know, publishing houses, say, or editors or the authors themselves. But when you're actually sitting down and doing the work and having to conceptualize, you know, the things that you're working on, is it lonely in that same way? Does it feel like a sort of solitary thing?
Oh, it is for me.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that's the same for all designers. I've had to accept that I'm sort of a loner creatively to some degree. And I learned that the hard way, working in different situations. Mm. You know, a graphic designer can be part of a large team or be an individual. And I sort of gravitated through trial and error to, you know, right now I'm working totally alone for the first time in a while. I usually keep a small office, but I'm back to working utterly alone right now, and I just prefer it that way. I'm not a big collaborator. I mean, collaboration's part of it.
Yeah,
for a writer too. Yeah, I think the parallels are, it's absolutely similar the way I work, the way a writer works. You know, and that goes for, you know, you call it collaboration. You could also call it compromise.
yeah.
And I don't, I'm pretty uncompromising. As a graphic designer, I think that's, it has its own, challenges that are different than what a writer might be running into along those lines. But, we all are, kind of fighting the same battles, I think, in a lot of cases. Mm.
You mentioned that you're kind of uncompromising. And so that, I guess the implication being that that leads to some challenges when it comes to working, you know, not working alone. But do you think that you have some leeway to be uncompromising because you've managed to achieve a certain level of maybe reputation or respect that you didn't have when you were younger, or when you were younger, was your kind of uncompromising nature in your work what maybe helped you become successful?
I would say both of those things are definitely true. When you're starting off, you know, it's hard to get anyone to listen to you for good reason. In a lot of cases, you know, what do you know? What did I know?
Yeah.
But I knew, you know, I went to grad school for graphic design as well as undergrad. So, you know, by the time I left school, I had learned how it needed to work for me, even if I didn't understand at all how it fit into the world, which I didn't. But
when you say it there, do you mean your process?
Yeah, the way it needed to work. I mean, you know, I think again, a graphic designer can get into all kinds of different things. Again, this is very different from, I guess it's the same with writing. I mean, a writer can, you can write for the news and work for a newspaper. You can write novels and be a creative genius, work alone. Yeah. And there's everything in between those two things. You can write ad copy, right? So, in grad school, I was designing my own typefaces and inventing everything, taking my own photographs and having total creative control over the work that I was doing. You know, even when I had clients when I was in college, you know, I did a lot of work for the School of Art Gallery. A lot of it was art-based and related to the design department. And, I was getting these things printed. So in some ways, it was like being a working designer who had clients and had to satisfy certain needs that related to those things. But it was very open and free. And, you know, when I started working, I got married and moved to Baltimore and started working at a marketing communications firm, you know, having loans and just having an understanding that this is what you do. You go out and you get a job, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was miserable. Oh my God. It just wasn't grad school. Whether that was process or whether that was the work we were working, the work that I was working on. We did a lot of work. They did a lot of work for colleges and universities. So there were these view books.
Oh yeah.
And it was, you know, in the end, it's all learning experience. And I realized I use those early work experiences every day, I think, even though there was a lot of misery for me involved creatively anyway. But I just pursued at that time work that wasn't related to it. I was interested in the theater and silkscreen. So I approached a theater and started doing silkscreen posters and, those posters were the things that got me into designing book covers.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Absolutely. It wasn't a plan. I just sort of stumbled into it. It was my need to have utter creative control over what I was making, but I still felt the need to have it have a purpose, I say, because, you know, while graphic design doesn't always need a client, it's certainly traditionally why the discipline exists, the profession exists.
Yeah.
So, it, no one was asking for work that I was doing on the job. They wanted these theater posters.
Yeah.
And the transition from doing that to getting paid to do book covers was sort of a revelation, but it wasn't something I could have planned.
So how are those posters that you were doing similar to book covers? Like what about them led you into the book covers?
Well, let's see. How could I sum this up succinctly?
Yeah, it's in speech and when people can't be looking at them, right?
Yes. Now, I mean, I think, sure. I mean, you know, with a book cover, there is it's a visual graphic representation of a story, a novel, the act of reading, right? And I think I would say the same thing about a theater poster. Most people see the poster before they see the show.
Sure.
Maybe the poster has information on it that you need, which is different from a book cover in some ways. You know, time, date, whatever, obvious stuff. But also, what is this show about? What am I getting into when I go to this thing? If I go to this thing, you know. I view both as a doorway to some experience that someone has. You know, with a book cover, you see the cover before you open the book. And frankly, I don't, with book covers and theater posters, while I think some of it's sort of interesting, I don't really, it's not my job to sell books. I don't care about the marketing part of it. I care about making something that's a doorway to an experience somebody's going to have and creating something that is appropriate and compelling and feels right for that situation.
Do you see yourself as being able to shape the experience of a reader with a book?
I guess that's true. But I would say that's not my mindset usually.
Yeah.
My mindset is usually to try to do justice to the book. And since, obviously the book's the important thing in the way I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. The cover is, look, let's get back to the marketing thing. people would disagree with me, but especially people in the marketing book department, but book covers do not sell books. You could have no cover. In fact, I've been threatening for years just to send in just something with nothing on it. If it's a good book,
yeah,
it will. One of your podcasts recently was on Confederacy of Dunces.
Yeah.
You know, that book sold without any marketing.
Yeah. Yeah.
A good book will sell. A bad book will not sell. Or a book that people don't like won't sell. And it doesn't matter what the cover is.
There's certainly plenty of bad covers on books that have been popular. Oh,
yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Maybe now that I think about it.
Yeah. No, I think a book cover can help the process somehow, but when it comes down to it, it's a dust jacket, you know? So I think that I don't have aspirations, or do I think it's a good idea for a designer to be messing around with creating, I don't know, your own sort of opinion about what you're getting into.
Right. Right. One of the things that I was thinking about is if you're thinking about designing a book cover, then ostensibly you'd have to read the book. So does the reading experience of a book that you know you're going to design a cover for, is that different than most other times that you read a book? Or are you kind of constantly always thinking about what book how you design the cover?
No, I'm ashamed to admit this, especially in the context of your podcast, but I really don't read anything now that isn't something I'm not assigned to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I imagine you've got, there's probably a lot of reading that you have to do, hours of it, yeah.
Yes, no. So I'm doing it all the time anyway. And quite often I gravitate toward more challenging books. So, you know, a lot of times you have to read them multiple times to even get a grasp of what it is, you know?
Yeah.
The reading is super important to me. And it, but it creates a sort of strange filter in terms of what I'm reading. But that gets also to the idea that I have to be super careful about what I agree to take on in terms of commission, because I have to read it. So I learned that again through trial and error. You know, I had this relationship with this art director. You assume that the creative director at the publisher, because I don't work at a publisher, I work for myself. A publisher calls me with a title that's on their list, thinking it's a good fit for me.
Yeah.
You know, you were talking about this idea of whether my reputation or doing it for long enough makes it easier to have control over what I'm doing. It certainly made it easier because art directors and creative directors sort of know what.
Yeah. What you're into.
Yeah. Or what would work given my approach, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but early on, that wasn't the case. So I'd be getting, you know, chick lit or whatever, which I'd like to think that as a male, I could design a book for women. But the times when I've attempted to read such books and design the cover, it never went well. I'll at least admit to that. So, you know, if there's a book about UFOs, Paul's the person to call. But I don't know about chick lit.
Yeah, yeah. So when you're working, so you get a manuscript, say, and someone, you know, you're working with some art director who you trust, and you agree to do it, and then you're reading the book. You mentioned you have to read it multiple times just to kind of get a sense of what it is, what it means, and so forth. Do you have to go through? Do you create multiple sort of mock-ups or iterations of what the cover could look like based on different understandings of it? Or do you do one and then you send it over and then they tell you, well, this isn't really what we were thinking, or this isn't really the direction, or this isn't really what the book actually meant? Or do you generally get what you want? Do they generally agree to what you propose?
No, I probably sound like the kind of designer who sends one cover in and says, this must be the cover. That is definitely not the case. Yeah. Either people can do that. I maybe used to think that there is one cover.
Yeah.
You know, for a book.
Yeah.
All things being equal, you know, in a perfect world, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I totally don't agree. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that, you know, it's funny getting back to that idea that, how important my voice maybe is in a cover commission as it relates to the book. And while I feel like it's not important at all in terms of the book, I have to have a point of view of the work that I make for the book. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny thing. Like, I really feel like those two things, you can't reconcile them on some level. And maybe that's what makes it interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But I think it's true. Like, I can't just be a chameleon and assume some role that doesn't relate to my what it is that I'm doing and the way I feel like it should go. So it's weird. There's a dichotomy there about design that I think is really fascinating and never understandable, and or it's always uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I just went off on a tangent there for a specific reason. What was the specific point of your question again?
I was just asking about how do you do multiple covers based on different understandings of it, of the book, that maybe you have to dialogue with the publisher or the author or whatever to kind of narrow down what might be the actual thing they're going for.
Well, I'll just quickly tell you how the process works.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, the marketing side is involved in this as well on the publisher side. So there's something called tip sheet. There's a synopsis of the book. They do a lot of sales stuff in there too, which I tend to ignore. But they, you know, similar titles, which I also can't stand and ignore totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that would become kind of a crutch if you're not being attentive.
Well, it's not even a crutch. It's just it's understandable. Look, the publisher wants to sell books, and they want to know, they want some track record for books that were successful. So this is why you see a lot of books that look similar out there that are in certain genres, right? Books that were successful, and so the marketing side feels more comfortable when you do a cover that's similar to this other book that's similar that did well, right? I mean, it makes sense. It's hogwash, but it makes sense. but anyway, I feel like, you know, there's also conversations with the creative director that's talked to the editor about the book. And, you know, there are oftentimes tacks, you know, that ways of approaching it that makes sense given larger themes that might not be readily understandable when you're reading a book that might inform what I do. So anyway, no, I usually will do multiple versions that I feel like could make sense for this particular book given certain other issues. And again, some of those are marketing, right?
Yeah. So you kind of have to take into account, you at least have to be aware of those marketing concerns.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Going into it without any of that is, it would make it very difficult, and just in a practical sense, to do work in this world that exists out there, you know? Sometimes most of the time you ignore it, or you make reference to it in some subtle way, but it's in there. But yeah, so I do multiple ones. You know, a recent cover that I did that sort of relates to this idea was one for Chuck Klosterman, who I've done covers for years.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that.
It's the Upside Down book. But what if we're wrong? That's what it is. But what if we're wrong?
Oh, yeah.
And Chuck is sort of kind of branching off from his, you know, pop culture zone into bigger questions with this book.
Yeah.
And so it's questioning big things like gravity and, you know, why we're here. So I was just like, hey, this is going to be impossible to get through. I knew this, but I talked to the creative director and said, look, it's just Upside Down. You know, we have a typeface that we use. And so there's a consistent vibe that goes through the books, the covers done over the years because of that typeface. But it's Helvetica. It's nothing. It's totally generic. Yeah. And so I'm like, it's totally generic and it's centered and it's as big as we can make it because Chuck's name is really long. And so it can only, with this typeface, his name can only get so big. So it's like that Upside Down, and that's the cover. And so I told the creative director, I said, listen, I know this is going to be almost impossible, but this shouldn't have any other text on it. There's no from the author of, or no subtitle or anything. For this to work, it's got to feel monumental. And I said, I know that's a tough sell, but and then that was that one that I felt really strong about, but I did three or four other ones that had space textures on it and other things. And it, you know, they ended up doing it.
Do you interact with Chuck Klosterman during this process, or is it just with the art directors?
Not at all. Not in this case. I've met Chuck a few times, but any interaction we have is highly controlled by the publisher. They definitely do not like it when the designer and the author go away secretly to waste money and time.
Of course not.
And again, that's totally understandable. They are publishing this book. They are investing in this book. They have to have control over how it's put out in the world.
So can I ask you a little bit more about this cover? Because you mentioned it's Helvetica, which is the font that you have used for all of his books. Is that right?
Yeah, starting with Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. I'll just say briefly, I can't remember what year that was, early 2000s, I think, but he had published a sort of a hair metal memoir before this. I believe this was his second book. And I didn't design the first one. I designed this one. This one was a bestseller. And so therefore the marketing people were like, well, all the books need to look like this.
So my question was going to be, is that good? I mean, is that make you happy? I mean, does that excite you that they like that? And so then they all want that same font. I mean, as you said, Helvetica is sort of this, you know, at this point, it's almost, you know, I don't know what the word is. It's almost
visible.
Yeah. That's great. That's a great word. I mean, so does it excite you to have to figure out how do I use this font? How do I use this aesthetic for the next 10 books, or are you like rolling your eyes and thinking, you know, well, there goes my fun?
Well, it's, but this falls in the category of branding the author.
Yeah.
Meaning similarity between covers so that you understand that the author's vibe, right?
So the author of this vibe in this case is invisibility.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, you know, Chuck's humor is pretty dry.
Yeah, yeah.
Biting, a lot of sarcasm in it.
Yeah.
And so, but it's also, and it's, you know, Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs is, you know, there's Beyonce in there, and it's pop culture references. And so I think it's fairly high-minded popular culture observations is the way I would describe it. And it's funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also fairly dry. So that was sort of the challenge with that one. Getting back to the way that question, mm-hmm. I think in this case, it made sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I sort of liked the sort of nothingness of it. It was sort of like the type was structured and almost nothing. And then there was some kind of image that there was a conceptual twist to. So, you know, the Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs is a bird's eye view of a cereal bowl with drugs floating in it instead of cereal.
Yeah.
So it's like sort of a forced idea in a way. Then I went back and was asked to redesign his first book, Fargo Rock City, that I mentioned, to work with this book. And so this is a cow that's got Gene Simmons.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah.
You know, fur thing.
Yeah.
and then the next one and on, right? So, yeah, I mean, no, I didn't roll my eyes at all. I thought this made sense. It was smart in not only in a marketing standpoint, but I think like I would separate marketing from kind of the branding part of it, even though the word branding relates to marketing.
Yeah.
Let's say it's got the covers have a cohesiveness and identity. I'm more comfortable talking about it that way. Mm. Because that's, yeah, why wouldn't you with an author that's doing writing a lot.
Yeah.
It's prolific.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's going to be a number of different titles here. They're all going to be related because of the author and the author's interests and point of view. Mm-hmm. So on that level, it makes sense that they're interconnected visually somehow. Mm.
So you use Helvetica, which you call invisible. But of course, it had its heyday, right? I mean, there's the documentary about it and everything. Was that what was when you thought let's use Helvetica back in the early 2000s? Was it that the sort of cultural imagination or the cultural perspective on that font was different at the time, or was the universality of it what was appealing to you within this context? Was there some kind of cultural understanding of that font that you thought would work well with what Klosterman was trying to do in his work?
Yes. I don't know if the time has that much to do with it. I mean, Helvetica was designed in the 50s and was designed specifically to be emotionless and generic. I mean, right. Generic's not the right word, but it was designed to not have the baggage that other typefaces might have. Mm-hmm. And therefore it's a modernist idea that you can apply this to anything. Because it doesn't have any personality. So you can apply it to the New York City subway and it just feels however it feels. Usually it's that modernist template and it has a very strong structure to it. And so his covers have that, some of that vibe in it, but I don't know if that changes, you know, the way Helvetica is viewed is always sort of been this, and now as it was 15 years ago when I started these titles, or however long it was. So yeah, it's sort of a system approach, an unemotional system approach that contrasts with the images that are normally on it. I want to say too that a conceptual twist on the cover that we were just talking about, but what if we're wrong, is just that it's upside down. I mean, funny enough, this one, you know, as a book cover designer, rightfully so, you know, the cover's rarely mentioned, you know. But this one, Chuck was on Late Night with Seth Meyers, and they start off, and he's got the book, and they start talking about the cover. Before they start talking about the book, they're talking about the cover. And Chuck actually went through he went through the process of how a book, you know, how he was shown it. And the thing he said that I loved, he referred to me as the design guy. He said, well, what's the track record of upside down books? and then they all, the market people scurry off and they come back and say, we can't find a book that's totally upside down. And then Chuck said, well, now we must do it.
So, that does sound like him.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I think probably I have some of Chuck's viewpoint on.
Yeah.
There's some similarities.
Kindred spirits, maybe.
Yeah. And so, you know, I told, like, that's a very anti-marketing approach, right? We don't know what's going to happen, but we got to find out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of beautiful in its way, I think.
So one of the things that when I'm looking at book cover, like I'm even looking at on bookcoverarchive.com, there's like a page for you on there. And there's, you know, so it's got, I don't know, 40 covers or something like that, maybe more. And, you know, in some cases they've got a more minimalist approach, you know, say. And then sometimes they're quite complex. Sometimes you've got, you know, symmetry, and sometimes there's asymmetry, and you've got complicated, complex typefaces, and sometimes they're Helvetica. So do you generally, when you're reading a book, do you have a sense that this book that I'm reading needs to have a more minimalist approach, or it needs to have a complex approach? And so then you know kind of immediately you're going to go to one side of those and create all your mockups in either a kind of a minimalist approach or a more complex approach. And those technical terms, I'm sure, for what I'm describing here, but, or do you kind of do one of each or try different, some maybe more complex with a lot of different elements and some more minimalist or so again, I guess the question is, put simply, do you know pretty quickly whether the book needs that more minimalist approach or not?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess I try to keep an open mind.
As I
start the process of designing. I mean, you know, after time goes on, I guess you get faster and better at being able to do things quickly, or determine what a book maybe quote needs. But I'm more sloppy and open minded, I think, about expectations about what something's going to be, and a lot of it's just the process of design. You know, I always feel too, design is essentially a process of finding something out. And so preconceiving going into it, I don't think is ever a good idea, even though, you know, after you've designed hundreds of book covers, it's human nature to sort of do that. But
yeah.
And I think for the better sometimes, I mean, you know, because we have budgets and deadlines and things have to be done.
Yeah.
So it's not an open-ended, it's not an open-ended process, but I try to keep an open mind. While you were doing that, I knew that I haven't been here in a while. I hate this website. I hate my page on here because there's so much stuff in here that it's just a mess. There's a lot of stuff in here I didn't design.
Oh, really?
I mean, there's paperback versions of things that got changed and messed with or that I didn't even do. Huh. There's one in here. It's how you play the game with colored dots on it. I didn't design that. There's probably 25% of these books I didn't design.
Interesting.
And I would say there's another 25% that were mucked with after I designed them internally, and a third reprinting of something, or a sticker was plopped on it or something. So it's a little infuriating. Actually, the internet's like this. But but that's, you know, here you talked about asides. I'm always really the design credit that is always something that I'd rather have my name not on something if I don't have 100% control over it than actually have my name on there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'll tell you one quick story. So a lot of times I go to the Strand in New York, down in the basement.
It's a great bookstore.
Awesome. But down in the basement, they have like, I don't know what the section is called, but it's just like they have tons of copies of the same books that didn't sell, and they're all packed down there. There's a term for it in the booksellers. But anyway, you know, when it's not a current book, it gets put down there, and if there are bunches of copies. So I'll go down there to get extra copies of books that I've designed for samples, whatever, oh, yeah, my archive. Yeah. And so I was working on this awful book called Cadillac Beach. This is one of the books that I'm talking about years earlier that I had to read, which I wish I didn't have to read, and try to avoid these types of books. But anyway, it was terrible. At a certain point, I just said, you know what? I'm resigning. I'm quitting. You guys go and find another designer. This is not working out. So, or I may have said, just do whatever you want with it. Just don't put my name on it. Anyway, I saw the spine said Cadillac Beach. I'm like, and it had this teal color that we were working with. So I'm like, oh God, what did they do with it? I pulled it off, and it was this awful cartoon of a pink Cadillac with teeth. It was just whatever. And so I'm like, oh my God, I'm laughing. And I'm like, who put this one to bed? And I opened the back set. It says design Paul Sayre. And I literally made like an audible, oh, like four or five people looked over at me. So, you know, it's like usually.
Can you do anything about that?
No.
I mean, I guess they've all been printed. What are you going to do?
I know. You
gotta, 1,000 copies or thousands of copies.
Who cares anyway, except for me. But yeah, so that happens a lot too. Anyway, that's an aside. You can...
Well, okay. So, you know, I was thinking about how. You did do the Hemingway books, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you had, I assume you were commissioned to do the whole series. You've got The Sun Also Rises, For Whom the Bell Tolls, A Farewell to Arms, The Old Man and the Sea, and so forth. That might cover it.
Yes.
But you've also done books by, you know, classic books or collections of short stories, or, you know, you did a Nabokov book, or however you pronounce his name. So I look at the Hemingway ones, and there is a sort of simplicity, you know, there's a symmetry to it, and you have the same sort of feel, and the way the typeface is laid out and everything is the same in all of those. I assume they asked you for something consistent across the series. Is that right?
Well, that one was, and again, because obviously it's posthumously and these are really well-known books, and this was more of a like, let's try to figure out some kind of series that updates the experience somehow. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't, I think, you know, publishers make most of their money on these types of books, and they just languish, you know, in terms of the covers. They don't need to redesign the covers because they're selling, and schools are buying them, whatever.
Yeah. But,
you know, in this case, they really felt like, you know, we need to update this, because the last time someone had designed the series, it was like 20 or 30 years ago. So they look very dated, and not dated in a way that relates to Hemingway, I guess I would say. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It felt like the early 90s. Hmm. In this case, I was using contemporary typeface and, imagery that evoke something, you know, from the book.
Did they ask you for something? I don't want to start something as straightforward as this. I don't mean that to be a derogatory word.
No. And these are similar to the what we're talking about with the Klosterman ones. We're thinking of them as a series.
Yeah.
And, you know, the type is super simple, sort of understated.
Yeah.
The classic in its way, you know, and then the imagery, again, relates to the book. Yeah. We did, again, with this one, we did maybe three or four different ways of approaching a series. And this was the one that was felt the most sort of contemporary and right for the moment. I think we did these.
Is it actually your favorite of the ones you did?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It is. Jason Fulford, photographer, was the photographer I was working with on these. And he, it's a subtle thing, but, you know, for the image for Old Man and Sea, he went out in a boat all day with a couple of old fishermen out in Montauk to get that image.
Yeah.
You know? The image from he didn't travel for all of these, but, Oh, right. He didn't do The Sun Also Rises, because this was a funny one. The creative director, John Fulbrook, at the time, called me and said, hey, would you like to redesign Ernest Hemingway's books? I'm like, of course. And he said, here's the catch, though. You know, the first one is Sun Also Rises, and it has to have a bullfighter on it. It's funny how, like, expats, like, you know, the romantic idea of expats, you know, and bullfighting seemed like a kind of avant-garde interesting idea. Now it's awful. So anyway, we use a stock photo. I'll make them blurry, you know, diffuse some of the awfulness involved. Yeah. But the rest of them were Jason. And, you know, he was threatening to rent a boat and sail to Cuba. And this was, this was like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I love the best plan.
I love that about him. And I definitely feel like, you know, the reader isn't going to be conscious about that, but that's in there. You know, if there's that much care and that much effort involved in, you know, the making of a cover, I think it resonates, you know?
Yeah.
In ways that, you know, can't really be articulated and probably wouldn't even be noticed, maybe. But it's in there.
So for something as simple as, like, symmetry, a lot of your work has, you know, well, I guess you seems like, I guess I don't know which covers on this list, for example, that you actually did now. But there's a lot of asymmetry. I'm looking at, did you do the Full Blood Arabian? Want the horses?
Yes. That was for New Directions. That's actually a soft cover poetry edition that they do.
So, you know, a book like that where the titles are sideways, and I mean, is that just something where you just kind of play with it and you have an image and you're like, well, so how do I fit this much text on it? I mean, I know there's a long line of text on the second line under the, you know, where it says who it's translated from. Right. So, I mean, I'm sure you have all these challenges you have to overcome or figure out how to solve, whether it's the amount of text on the cover or the sort of whatever the size of the book actually is and so forth. So when it comes to asymmetry versus symmetry, do you sort of just worked instinctively on that, or do you use symmetry versus asymmetry strategically, if that makes sense?
I use it strategically. I would say most of my work has elements of both. And for your listeners, what you're talking about with asymmetry and symmetry is a basic compositional kind of idea. And it gets to three elements that should be in design. And that is a sense of balance. And that's asymmetry or symmetry. A sense of unity, that things feel like they belong together. Because a lot of times we forget about a book cover, for instance. Someone, in this case me, is combining elements that are disparate, that don't belong together. You know, it could be a photograph, typeface, forms, right, that are very different from each other, color, texture. And then it should have a sense of movement to it. So getting back to the idea of balance, symmetrical balance is a very, very natural kind of thing. You know, it's like, think of a drop of water going into a puddle, right? Mm-hmm. Symmetry is a very natural occurrence. Asymmetrical balance is sort of very unnatural in some ways. But asymmetry is as a way of balancing a composition is much more interesting usually to look at, because it's sort of like the analogy of chair is perfectly balanced. Doesn't feel like it's going to fall over, but it's not something you want to look at for an extended period of time and contemplate, right?
Yeah.
Asymmetry is more like a high wire act. Like something could fall, a person could fall at any minute, so you can't take your eyes off of it. That is the non-academic way I would describe that. Composition is as complicated as music theory.
Yeah.
If you can believe it. Of course, you know. Well,
isn't there a famous book design book that actually talks about the elements of design as being like the notes of music? I feel like I just read this. I can't remember.
There probably is. There's definitely parallels there.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a science to it. Anyway, I tend to incorporate both quite often in my work. And usually it gets, I think it gets more interesting when you are playing with those two ideas and not quite ever kind of landing in one place or the other. Mm. Now, I say that, again, getting back to that Chuck Klosterman book with the center type, that one's totally symmetrical. But the thing that I would consider sort of asymmetrical in it, even though it's more of an idea than actually forms being moved in different places, is that it's upside down.
Yeah.
Right? It's a twist.
So your brain is still kind of responding to it like it, as if it were asymmetrical.
Yes. Yeah. And so I'm looking on this thing. It's funny that cover you, this is another thing that might be an aside, but it's definitely something that needs to be said. In this case, you know, this cover, the Full-Blooded Arabian, was a cover that I actually didn't design with my own hands. My designer, Eric Carter, designed this cover. I may have looked at this set and four or five other ones and said, hey, that one's great. Let's do that one. Okay. And maybe shove this over a little bit. So, you know, while I probably more than most designers am hands-on and like it that way, there have been times over the years where a designer who worked for me did most of the heavy lifting.
Sure.
And that's the case here. I just wanted to mention that. But, you know, that's what makes it. If I was just doing this book cover archive, I probably wouldn't put this cover on there just because I didn't have. But that, again, like it was done for the from the office of Paul Sayre. So
it's,
you know, I mean, it's funny because the cover next to it here, we're referring to this thing and your listeners can't see it. But I did a series of covers for Clarice Lispector, the Brazilian author. New Directions has been doing new translations of her for an English-speaking audience, which is amazing. And it introduced me to her, which I'm very thankful for. But in this case, there were four different covers because they'd been written in the 60s, whenever they were 50s and 60s, whenever they were written. And it gave us the opportunity, gave me the opportunity to kind of not think of the covers. I didn't need to read these books. In fact, I haven't read two of them, because what we did was we used it as a way to put the author front and center with these covers. And so and she was just an incredible looking person. There's no other way to describe it at every point in her life. And so this is a really beautiful photograph of her as a young author. And so it was a way for us to sort of like design four books with the same image. So it's sort of a puzzle. Each book has a piece of her face, and then the books can be sort of, you can kind of put them together and it completes the portrait. And again, that these covers, I would say, are symmetrical in their way, but also very asymmetrical, because when you put them all together, it's a very symmetrical experience. But each individual cover is very asymmetrical because it's only a part of it.
So do you have instances where, you know, the text might be symmetrical, but then the image behind it is asymmetrical, and vice versa? Is that is that a way to play with it a little bit, or
yes, absolutely, sure. Yeah.
Would you consider that where a designer is just having fun, or is there a strategic way? Like you're actually trying to do something to, well, I don't mean to say that you're being manipulative or something, but that you're trying to do something with the imagination or brain of the person who's looking at it. Or is it more you having fun?
No, I think it's probably both, frankly, because I love composition.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I love it's moving things question. Around. I love moving things around on a page and then see what happens. It's, why I have no idea.
Well, I guess that's why you do the job, right?
I guess you don't question at a certain point. I'm looking at another one here, The Visible Man by Chuck Klosterman, and it takes the idea of this Helvetica and centered thing, but I actually put type on a wall, and the image in itself is very symmetrical. If you look at it, the seam of the room is right in the middle. The type is centered, but then the elements of the room are mixed up and asymmetrical. The windows on the left, the plants sort of on the left, a little further over, and this image on the right of a person holding up a piece of paper in front of their face is on, yeah. on the right in the upper portion. And the thing I love about playing with form in this way in terms of composition is, you know, if you take one of those elements out, the cover sort of doesn't work compositionally. So I think that these sort of ideas are, like I said, the analogy of the high wire act is perfect. Again, there are many instances in music where you want something that you're playing to resolve or to make the listener hang for a minute and then it resolves, you know.
Yeah.
This you're sort of doing it in one flat thing. You know, it's not a linear experience, a book cover, unless it's moving, of course. Maybe we're heading there. We certainly are in the terms of how they're marketing books now.
Yeah.
I don't get a lot of requests to do that, but you know, you a lot of times you'll see on a website somewhere where the book cover is animated.
Yeah.
So it's not time based, but it sort of is, because you want to engage somebody, and you know, compositional ideas are meant to, you know, move the eye around the page and engage, you know.
I'm fascinated by that idea that if you take one element off, it doesn't work. Is that something that you're kind of constantly after, like that to you, when you get to the point where there's nothing that could be taken off the page, that's sort of where you've met the demands of that cover? Maybe you've even gotten to where that it's just like that's a perfect cover for the setting, for that particular book.
Yeah, sure. But now it's sort of automatic. It's just automatic, you know, where I don't have to actually think about it.
Because you got experience.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Again, the music thing would be a perfect example. If you're learning, it's very, you're concentrating what you're doing. But when you're actually playing, you don't think about it. You just do it.
And it's,
that's not right. You're right. Yeah. There was a cover I did years ago for Rick Moody called Demonology. And that one.
It's right here, yeah.
It was, that one is exactly this. The typography is centered. The smarties are centered, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like a totally symmetrical thing. But if it's just symmetry, again, it's like looking at a table. It's a table. It's not falling over. It's balanced, but it's not interesting. The same with like a flag. Flags, you want symmetry in a flag. Like the Japanese flag, awesome flag.
Yeah.
A flag, very memorable, but you don't dwell on it
even
for a second. So that's what this is doing. But if you look at it, the idea behind it is that the smarties are levitating. They're sort of doing some creepy, subtle thing. It's unnatural.
Yeah.
And they're just ever so slightly tipped. Like they're not perfectly straight up or down.
Yeah.
Gives the feeling of, it helps to enforce the feeling, but the fact that they're just, it's just not quite perfect is the thing that activates that cover.
About it. There's a little, twisty piece on the plastic. Yeah. Wrappers at the top sort of curved a little bit.
Yeah, and the same with that. I do a lot of work for the band They Might Be Giants, and the first album cover I did for them was for a release called Join Us, and it's got a ridiculous monster hearse. It's a hearse that's a monster truck. It's pink, and it's crushing. We were talking about Helvetica. It's crushing Helvetica. It's riding over, right? The fact that when I presented the idea to the band, John Flansburgh was like, I love it, but we're not a Helvetica band. He said to me, it's great. But then I said, no, but it's an anti-modernist statement. It's crushing Helvetica. And then he was like, oh, it's great. But if you look at that album cover and you put your hand over the truck, you'll notice the type barely is moving. But when the truck is in there, it's just one word that's at an angle. The rest of it's very structured, but it's sort of an optical illusion. But it just, in concert, it totally works, and it feels like the Helvetica is being starting to be crunched, like a car, you know, would be underneath the wheels. Again, these are all. I love that we're able to sort of geek out to this level, because I think it's like these are the things that make you want to get up in the morning and
yeah.
what you do. You know?
Yeah. So when you're doing these covers, do you have to work in concert with the layout people, you know, people who are laying out the text? I mean, are you asking them, you know, what typeface are you using for the title page, for headers, for...
Oh, the interiors. Yeah. Weirdly enough, no. Most of the time, not. There are some publishers who coordinate that. And most of the time, as you probably notice, they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a number of different reasons for that. Each publisher typically has a department that where the designers are just doing interiors.
Yeah.
And then their cover department is maybe on a different floor and they
or being outsourced.
Or being outsourced, yeah.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. So no, typically, which seems weird on the face of it, but I would also say that, you know, they also do a lot of things in publishing where, you know, they'll do a hardcover edition of something and then it's a dust jacket. And then they decide, we got to do a paperback. And now the cover is going to be totally different because it didn't sell for whatever reason. So they're shifting it thinking that, you know, a different cover will make it sell. I mean, the fact that it's less expensive and it's a paperback is the reason that sells better than the hardcover in that situation, not because the cover would, again, I don't have empirical proof. That's my feeling about it. So we might as well just do a beautiful lasting book cover. Right. But anyway, that's one of the reasons why that I think that is the case.
Is it common for, I mean, how often would you say your name gets, the cover design gets put on? It's pretty often, right?
Yes. You know, it's funny. I'm sure there were designers who fought very hard for that, for that to even happen. But it's weird because from my perspective, it becomes a sort of strange political football. If it happens, again, we're talking about clients and deadlines, and I have relationships with different people. And because of the process, many people are involved in deciding what a cover is going to be. Something goes south and I don't want my name on it. If I say to a creative director that I don't know well, I can certainly do it with a correct creative director I know well. Let's just get it done and do what you need to do with this thing. Just don't put my name on it. Fine, whatever. So it's some version of what I did, but it's not something that I would have wanted to be associated with. That happens. But if I do that with a creative director I don't work with a lot, they take offense. Well, you don't like it? Well, no, I just don't have control over it. I don't feel comfortable. I think a lot of times designers just put their name on it and don't have the same threshold I do, but I know I haven't worked with certain people again because I did that. Hmm. Even if you do it in the nicest, most professional way. So it's weird. Sometimes I feel like, you know, not sometimes. It's my name. I decide whether it's on there or not.
Yeah.
And I'd rather not have it on there in this particular case, you know?
Yeah. So, okay, I'll let you go. And I've used enough of your time, but I got a couple more questions. You got time for a few more?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I guess these are kind of rapid fire type questions, I suppose. But is there a book cover out there that you wish you'd designed? Or just a book cover that you really love? It's kind of an inspirational, something that you...
Sure. I don't think there's anything... there are book covers I think are great, but I don't know if I think about it like I wish I designed that. I would have said that if you asked me that question 20 years ago, I probably would have been able to answer it absolutely and give you examples, but not now. I don't know exactly why that is. I'll give you a lot of covers I love. This is probably my favorite book cover ever. It's by Ray Johnson. It's In the American Grain.
Is that Carlos Williams one?
Yes. New Directions. Maybe 50s, 60s, this was published. And I don't know what it is about this cover, but I just love this cover. It's so nothing, but it's got a hand on it.
Yeah, I see it, yeah.
And the type is just sort of seemingly unconsidered, but it's just, I think it's beautiful.
The black and white, it's kind of a black and white photo. Yeah.
But I remember where I saw this cover. I was in I was visiting Yale, the design grad school at Yale, to do a lecture or something up there. And I was in the bookstore that was near campus and I pulled this off. It's like, oh, but he's not a graphic designer. He's an artist, outsider artist. So I will definitely say this, it's like artists who do design work oftentimes, especially posters, it's usually the worst poster ever. Like Picasso poster design. Don't do it. That's always the thing with the museums. It's like, here are some posters and they're by Picasso or whoever. And it's like, they're the worst posters ever.
As much as it's only good as a curiosity.
Yeah. I don't know. They think because it's Picasso.
So you said it's kind of nothing, but what is it about it that is inspiring to you?
If you look at this thing, it probably looks like something I might even designed, because it does a lot of things we were just talking about. There's just something off about it that's right.
Yeah.
And that activates it. It's almost nothing, but it that aspect is there's something not reconcilable about the elements and how they were combined, but it works.
Well, it's got that like subtle asymmetry. I mean, obviously in the American grain is pretty tilted, but even the way the fingers are kind of the middle finger and the ring finger are kind of split just slightly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just something compelling.
The shadows.
They're very compelling about it. I'll just leave it at that. But I love that color.
Is there a classic book, maybe a classic work of literature that if you ever got the chance to redesign the cover for, you'd be really excited?
These should not be hard questions. This should be pretty easy. Often people are asking me, what would be your dream project?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have any. Well, how about this? One of my favorite books is called The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins. I'd love to redesign this cover. It's an amazing book. Mm.
The one on from the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. The 70s cover. Those 70s covers are, it's like those old, the one with the
illustration.
Yeah,
the illustration. The crazy amoeba. That one's pretty hard to beat. That's the one I have. But these covers are terrible.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting, important book, in my opinion. But
is there an era of book design that you're most inspired by, or that, if you had posters in your office or something or in your studio, that maybe most of them are from a particular era? Maybe decade. I don't know how you define eras.
Yeah,
book design.
I would probably say not something I'm aware of consciously, but certainly the 50s was sort of, in some ways, and that might just be a perception of a couple of designers, Paul Rand and Alvin Lustig, their cover work. Probably because they're so singular, and talk about uncompromising and putting the book first. Certainly Lustig's covers are have a consistency that I really respond to. That certainly is not my approach. But I would also say there are great, John Gall's a great book cover designer. Now is a great time for book cover design, even more so than maybe even 5 or 10 years ago, because of what's going on with all the digital stuff. I think there's much more care given to covers now than there ever has been. Chip Kidd, I used to, in college, he was just starting. He's a few years older than me, but I would definitely say his work just blew my mind when I saw it. And he's still doing great work now. Peter Mendelsohn, great designer.
You mentioned Paul Rand. Is that the IBM guy?
Yeah, he designed the IBM logo.
Okay.
He did a lot of really big identities, Westinghouse, but he did a lot of book design, book cover design, book design. And he's probably the most famous, well-known graphic designer.
Well, I kept you long enough. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground. This was fun. You were glad we got to nerd out, but that's one of the reasons I was hoping to talk to you is because I love just asking questions about some of these things. So I could probably have spent, an hour just taking three of your covers and asking you questions about what your choices were there. So I appreciate that but I'm sure you don't want to keep, thinking about them too much, but I appreciate some time to go over a few of them with me. I had a good time.
I did as well, David. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mr. Paul Sayer for joining me here on Libromania. To learn more about Mr. Sayer, you can head over to paulsayer.com. It's SAHRE. So paulsayer.com. You can also check out his book, Two Dimensional Man, at amazon.com or wherever you buy books. As always, thanks to you for listening. If you like this podcast, please remember, subscribe, rate, review, leave a 5-star review if you enjoyed this podcast. Tell your friends to subscribe. Help us spread the word. I would greatly appreciate that. Don't forget about all the other great content here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. We've got Close Reads, where we're discussing novels. Currently, we're going through Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen with special guest Karen Swallow Pryor. We've got The Daily Poem, where we are bringing you a poem each weekday morning. We've got The Play's a Thing, which is all Shakespeare, all the time. For all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thank you so much for listening, and happy reading. Talk to you next week on Libromania.